This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. If you've ever taken a field trip to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, you probably remember Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis and the Apollo 11 lunar capsule. Pretty soon, one of the most famous spaceships of all will be displayed there as well. But this one doesn't have anything to do with NASA. Richard Paul has the story of the vessel that's about to go where no giant prop has gone before.
At the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, they have curators for all the things you'd expect. You know, telescopes, missiles, planetary science, space shuttles. They're all over on that side. On this side is something completely different. The collection of curator Margaret Weidekamp.
What you see here is our collection of toy ray guns.
Who else gets to say that at work every day?
Everything from a Buck Rogers water pistol, the Wilma Deering girls version of the gun that came out a year later, as well as cap guns. We also have plastic toys.
Margaret's title is curator of the social and cultural dimensions of spaceflight. What she has is more than 4,000 pieces of space-related ephemera. And her Buck Rogers XZ-31 rocket pistol isn't even the coolest piece of super nerdy space stuff in her collection. Margaret's principal obsession these days is an object that may resonate more deeply than anything else in the museum's collection, at least for the generation that grew up when America was going to the moon.
Space, the final frontier.
For the past 17 months, in a room inside a Smithsonian facility in Virginia, Margaret and a team of conservators have been working on that very ship, the one you saw fly by whenever you heard those words on TV.
So this is it. This is the studio model of the Star Trek Starship Enterprise.
The Enterprise? I should have known. I bet Jim Kirk himself hauled the old gal out of mothballs to come looking for me.
It hasn't been in mothballs exactly, but kind of close. The Smithsonian got the ship 6 years after NBC canceled the original Star Trek in 1968. They had it out on the main museum floor for a while, but for the past 14 years, it's been hanging in the gift shop. Margaret said they heard from a lot of Star Trek fans who considered it a sign of disrespect that the Enterprise was hanging there next to the tchotchkes and refrigerator magnets, and she wanted to move it.
I had been looking for a new place for it for some time, but it needed to be a permanent place where it would be well contextualized with other objects.
She's finally found that place, and it's the most eminent one in the museum, the entryway of the Milestones of Flight Gallery, where they have all of American history's most important planes and rockets, the very first thing that 7 million people a year see as soon as they walk into the museum. This way, she says,
we could put the Enterprise model next to the lunar module, which is in some ways a contemporary spacecraft. We could put it next to the Telstar Flight Spare, which is the first telecommunications satellite and begins this world of television and communication.
All that's coming soon, but now it's here, lying on a workroom table.
I'd love to tear this baby apart.
Well, they have.
If you're looking at the table, we have the saucer right in the front, and behind that on the table, we have the long, thin engines, and you'll notice that the engineering hull or the secondary hull is actually missing. It's on a cart that's separate because there's cracking in between the wooden pieces because the adhesive that they used has aged.
You probably figured the Enterprise model was made out of plastic or metal.
In fact, it was made out of wood. You'll see, actually, that the engineering hull is constructed like a barrel out of individual staves.
It's actually bigger than you'd likely imagined it would be.
The Enterprise model is as big as a banquet table. And as we look at the starboard side of the model, you'll notice that it's really well detailed because that was the side that faced toward the camera all the time.
And though you've probably never realized it, you've only seen this side of it. That's because the other side doesn't look like a starship that would haul you from galaxy to galaxy. It kind of looks like someone's unfinished woodshop project.
The inside of the model is largely hollow because that's where the wires would run through. And so as you look in, you can see the raw ends of pieces of plex that have been hammered through the secondary hull and not really finished off in any particular way, because what they needed was just to be able to put a light source inside that hull, and it would then shine out through all of these windows, creating the effect.
An illusion placed in our minds by this planet's inhabitants.
We are working on a whole series of structural and aesthetic issues. The cracking and crazing on the top of the saucer paint, which is original, and you can see that, really looks a lot like what you would see in a fine art painting. For that, we're really just trying to clean and stabilize.
Most people think of the National Air and Space Museum as that place you go on your eighth grade trip to Washington, where you take a selfie in front of the space toilet or Neil Armstrong's flight suit. And it is that, but bottom line is, it's also a place for learning.
Learning, Shauna. All your people must learn before you can reach for the stars.
While it's principally a history museum, they also teach a lot of science and engineering here.
One of the things I want you to notice on the airplane, which is really important, was that they were bicycle makers.
And that's museum educator Beth Wilson standing in front of the Wright Brothers airplane. And that's not a model. It's the actual plane they flew at Kitty Hawk in 1903, the first heavier-than-air machine ever to fly.
To create lift, you have to have an airfoil. And an airfoil is a very particular shape. And the Wright brothers tested a lot of different airfoil shapes. And you can actually see the airfoil used in the wing of the airplane.
So science, she says, is what the museum is really pushing now.
Because STEM education is so important. So we try and wrap some science, technology, engineering, and math around everything that we do.
And that's easy to do here because you can demonstrate principles next to real, honest-to-goodness scientific artifacts.
The rule of thumb for the museum is that if it flew and came back, we have it. For something like the lunar module, the Hubble Space Telescope, they didn't come back. So we either have the engineering backups or the program ended and we have it. So it's all real.
Now, it's one thing to teach astronomy using the engineering model of the Hubble Space Telescope. But how do I put this? The Starship Enterprise never really existed. So can you use that to teach? Margaret Weidekamp did. Before she was hired at the Smithsonian.
I had been teaching classes on space history and science fiction because I saw those topics as very connected.
And when she says teaching classes, that's not at some Star Wars convention or space nerd fantasy camp. It was undergraduate history students when she was a postdoc at Cornell. So yes, you can use it to teach. Beth Wilson does it all the time.
When the science is there and it's good, and the imagination is there and it's good, then the science fiction is great, and you can use all that to teach.
Many myths are based on truth, Captain.
You look at something like 2001 A Space Odyssey, and you look at that space station. You know, they wanted to create gravity, so they really looked at the science and how to make that spin and how that would create gravity. So that's really good science.
Star Trek is loaded with really good science, too, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it's inspired generations of astronauts and space scientists.
I was very much a Star Trek fan, and I like to say that I watched in the 60s when it first came on.
That's astronaut Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman in space, talking on C-SPAN.
I thought the show was very wonderful because it put women in non-traditional roles. So Lieutenant Uhura was maybe the first woman that you saw every week on television who worked in a technical field.
Security sweeps of all decks are negative, Mr. Spock. No evidence of intruder.
Also, she was African. I since met Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek, and we've become friends. She also was very instrumental in recruiting the first women and minority astronauts for NASA.
You'll find this sense of inspiration in the Smithsonian, too.
The museum listens carefully to fans of Star Trek,
That's Margaret Weidekamp again.
In part because we're also fans of Star Trek. And in fact, 20 years ago, the very first gift that my husband ever gave me was a little Lieutenant Worf figurine that he picked up when he was in Los Angeles. And so being able to put those kinds of cultural objects on display allows the museum to really deepen the stories of the science and technology by drawing forward the stories of the people who have just been fans of fictional visions of what going into space might look like.
Okay, so here's where we're going to put the Enterprise. So as soon as you walk in, you'll see the Enterprise, and then you'll open up to the Boeing Milestones of Flight Hall, where you can see the lunar module, the Spirit of St. Louis is in there, Spaceship One, so there's a bunch of cool stuff.
And so, with its new prominent place at the Smithsonian, it nearly guarantees that for years to come, space science fiction and Star Trek will continue to
live long and prosper.
That was Richard Paul, and you can see pictures of the Starship Enterprise being restored at the Smithsonian at Studio360.org.